This week on KPBS Roundtable, a new series from KPBS examines how schools are managing the mental health of students.
Most students who need help don't seek it. And so it's really important that the services be brought to the children instead of relying on children to identify and seek out help.
Then we get an update on a busy sports week for San Diego fans. We'll discuss the new seasons for the Padres and the Wave FC, and how the Aztec men's basketball team once again met their match against the Yukon Huskies. That and our weekly roundup coming up next on Roundtable.
You've been thinking about helping KPBS with a donation. Why not donate that extra car you no longer need? Pickup is free, and you're supporting KPBS Public Media. Here's how. Visit kpbs.careasy.org.
The number of young people experiencing poor mental health is on the rise, according to the CDC. A new three-part series from KPBS examines mental health in schools. It includes stories from students and teachers, as well as therapists and administrators trying to improve mental health outcomes in young people today. I'm joined now by Katie Heisen. She is KPBS's racial justice and social equity reporter. Katie, welcome back to Roundtable.
Thanks for having me.
And before we begin, we should note we will be talking about mental health and suicide. If you or someone you know is having thoughts of suicide, you can call the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline at 988. Katie, let's start big picture. How are students faring with their mental health, and what kind of mental health resources are available to them?
The short answer is not well. The CDC has been doing these surveys of students since the early 90s. They've surveyed millions of students across the country. And the last one they released was for 2021. And it showed an increase in reporting poor mental health really across all groups of youth, including increased thoughts and behavior of suicide, self-harm. So it was really alarming. There are therapists in most schools in this area, but the counselor-to-student ratio is about half what's recommended. And the budget is really limited right now. There's this gap, right, in what people think would be the best approach to address this crisis and what they're financially able to do. But I also found really unique new programs and approaches they're trying. So I'm eager to see the 2023 results of this survey to see if that rise has continued or if some of these experimental programs are starting to have an effect.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's jump into how some of these schools and educators are trying to respond to this crisis. How has this situation in the way that educators are thinking about mental health, how has that changed over the years? What did you find in your reporting?
I think for one, mental health is a lot more normalized and destigmatized, it seems, than when I was growing up. It's understood how common these struggles are. And something I found interesting is like a very recent shift into, instead of relying on students to seek out help, they're proactively bringing programs and screening to students and at a pretty young age. So they're screening students as young as second grade in some of these districts. And screening everyone. You know, a lot of professionals told me that most students who need help don't seek it. And so it's really important that the services be brought to the children instead of relying on children to identify and seek out help.
That's fascinating. When I think about how mental health entered the conversation when I was in school, usually it wasn't really brought up much until high school, and even then it probably wasn't sufficient. But so to hear that it's entering the conversation as young as second grade, I mean, that's fascinating. What does that look like for younger students when these schools are rolling out the curricula focused on mental health?
So it's very different between districts right now. and even between schools inside districts. One place I found fascinating to visit was Ehe Charter School, Ehe Academy's Charter School in El Cajon. They have baked social-emotional learning into their curriculum, elementary school through middle school. And I watched children learning things that I wish I had learned at their age. It took me until my late 20s to get into therapy and learn some of the tools these children are not just learning, but I watched them actively use these tools. Things like asking yourself, how big is your problem? You know, is someone in danger? Things like identifying your emotions and then coming up with practical ways to manage those emotions. So for the younger children, this can look like they use colors to identify how they're feeling. So I watched third graders say, you know, it's going to be hard for me to learn today because I'm feeling yellow. I'm feeling very silly and it's hard for me to focus. Another student would say, I'm in the blue zone today. I didn't sleep well and I'm really tired. And then together, the students would decide what they were going to do to help get them in a space to learn. So for that day in this third grade classroom, they decided they really needed a brain break. And they all danced for a few songs next to their seats. And so it's introducing as a normal way of thinking to self-reflect on what state you're in, what you need, and to come up with a plan. And it progresses as they get older. In the eighth grade at this school, there's a whole class on stress management. And for their final project, they have to come up with a plan that's individualized for themselves of how they're going to manage their stress. And so I was really taken aback. I mean, it definitely wasn't like that in school when I was young.
And you spoke with a mother named Melissa Gonzalez, who noticed a change in her daughter, Celise, since taking part in this social emotional learning at school. Here's what she had to say.
Her ability to articulate her emotions has improved a lot. And she can sit down and talk and sometimes go on and on a while about how she's feeling, which is really good.
And so I'm curious, you spoke a little bit about some of the activities involved. I'm wondering for the younger students, you know, do the lessons specifically address mental health topics? Do they talk about it in some of the clinical language that we hear maybe in therapy? Or is it more about designing activities that activate parts of their brain related to emotional regulation or healthy thinking?
That's a good question. I think it's much more approachable and strikes me as very age appropriate. So they'll just kind of have these conversations without even necessarily labeling it mental health curriculum. You know, they'll ask students to, I watch them complete a worksheet on, you know, what do you think makes a good friend? And how can you be a good friend to someone around you? Or like I mentioned, what color are you feeling? They're not therapizing children in the clinical way that you or I might talk about therapy or might have been familiar with it growing up. It's very practical and age appropriate from what I saw.
And now for older students, ones in high school, what does it look like to be focusing on mental health for them? Because obviously when you start to get into your teenage years, you have different challenges, different stressors. You know, from what you observe with the students you talk to, what does it look like for them in high school?
It again depends on the district and the school. There's a few schools that have built these wellness centers inside the school where a student can take a break, eat a snack, talk to a professional. But again, limited budget to roll out these things that seem positive. Students say they're very helpful, but there's limited budget to roll it out everywhere. And the other thing that struck me was that some of this work is very student-led. Students are voicing what they need and also participating in how to address it. And so there's a team of San Diego Unified students working with UCSD to develop a new mental health curriculum. The details aren't public yet. It's still in development. But it really struck me actively the students themselves are participating.
From what you could tell talking to the students, did there seem like there was, you know, they identified a need for this, a demand for this?
Definitely. And I would say, you know, a few things came up over and over again from professionals and from students across the board. It was COVID, social isolation, social media, really like a lack of social connection that was driving a lot of these mental health issues.
That's fascinating. Yeah. In your reporting, did you find any opposition to this push for curricula and lessons that are designed around mental health or with mental health as a centerpiece?
I didn't find that in my reporting, but this is also on such a small scale still. Like AHA Charter School, you know, the families opt in and choose to go to a school that has that kind of curriculum. Some of the other efforts aren't rolled out widespread in districts yet. I just moved here from reporting in Florida a year ago, and it was interesting. There was pushback there to this kind of curriculum. It had become politicized in a way that many other topics in school boards and in schools had become politicized. And so I'm curious, as these approaches and curriculums get rolled out on a wider scale and even in new districts, I'm wondering if we'll see that happen.
You cite some alarming statistics in your series. You know, more than 1 in 5 high school students have seriously considered suicide. I mean, that should be a red flag, a bright red flag for any parent or any community member. I mean, what's happening here?
Yeah, my stomach dropped when I read that statistic. Not just the 1 in 5, but the wording that they had seriously considered it. I think that's the question. What's happening here is what these screening programs and surveys are scrambling to answer. I think there are some driving factors, like I mentioned, social isolation, social media, COVID. But I think that's the question that professionals are trying to answer. What is happening and how can we address it? And I'm really curious to see the next set of survey results, if that trend continues or if we see it go down with the more distance we get from COVID.
And you report that nearly half of LGBTQ plus students have seriously considered suicide. And I mean, that is truly staggering. What specific struggles do LGBTQ plus students face?
Yeah, the survey shows that they're harassed at higher rates for that identity than are straight students. That didn't surprise me. But what surprised me was that amount of harassment they reported as rising in recent years. And I think depending on the district you're in, some of these students also feel like they can't seek help from the school.
How are the actions of certain school districts either helping or hurting these LGBTQ plus students?
As part of this reporting, I looked at a series of actions taken by districts surrounding San Diego that really affected LGBTQ plus students, from gender notification policies where school staff are required to tell the parents if their child requests to use a different pronoun or name or a different bathroom, they have to notify the parents. There were also, safe space stickers and pride flags taken down in classrooms. And one school district even terminated the contract with a mental health service provider after community complaints that provider also gave services to LGBTQ plus youth. So there's all these little policy changes and actions that sent a message to LGBTQ plus students this school year.
You spoke to one student, Moxie Childs, who is a junior in Temecula. Moxie is gay and trans, and here's how he explained the experience of LGBTQ plus students in Temecula.
It's hard to be open, and it took a while for me to accept myself. It takes a while for anyone to accept themselves, but especially in a setting like how Temecula is right now, where that sort of thing is being shunned and ostracized and punished, it gets a lot harder.
And I'll note that in your reporting, Temecula Valley Unified School District declined to comment on the details of your story. What was your reaction when you heard Moxie say that?
There were several moments in his interview where I had to pause just to keep my emotions in check as a reporter. The things Moxie and other students like him are facing would be hard for anyone, but it was really clear in the interview, you know, if you see Moxie, this is still a child that I'm talking with who is facing really adult problems. And I think what struck me is, you know, I grew up in the 90s in Florida, and it struck me how much of this conversation, even 30 years later in a very different place, was the same. But I did also see more students pushing back and asserting their identity much more than I saw around myself growing up. And I think that just speaks to, you know, their courage and resilience. I wish all the listeners and readers of this story could hear from Moxie in person and just see what a remarkable person he is.
And Moxie has been one of those students pushing back against the school district's policy decisions. What actions has he taken, and how have those actions been received by, you know, fellow students or the school district or the broader community?
Yeah, so after the school district passed a policy that classrooms could not hang any flags except the state or U.S. flag without approval, specific approval. And that was used to back taking down all the pride flags. And so Moxie decided to hand out pride flags on sticks. And he said that, you know, a lot of students would try to would grab them and try to rip them up. But because the flags were more plasticky than they were fabricky, that they couldn't be ripped. And so these students would just be struggling.
Maybe a certain metaphor there.
Yeah. And it was nice. I mean, Moxie was laughing at this point, and it was nice to see him still, you know, laugh and find humor. But on the other hand, he said he had students come up to him who come out to him, you know, who saw him as a safe person following that coverage. And he said he's had students, trans students, reach out from across the country after that the news coverage came out of what he did, just feeling able to safely speak to him. And that's something I saw, especially for these vulnerable students in districts where they feel like they can't go to the institutions for support. They're really finding it in each other.
When reporting this three-part series on mental health in schools, what surprised you the most?
I think just that stat. 1 in 2 LGBTQ plus students seriously considered suicide. I mean, it, like you said, it's staggering, and I have not stopped thinking about it since I read that.
And what can parents do if they want to see more mental health resources or better mental health resources in their children's schools?
This is going to sound like a nerdy response, but I really believe it's true. I've been reporting for 5 years. Most of these decisions get made on the school board level, and parents can make their preferences known to their representatives. You can vote who sits on those school boards. I know attending meetings is often less accessible for the people that face the highest inequities in the school system, but you can leave a written comment. Oftentimes you can join over Zoom for public comment. And the other thing is that journalism is shrinking. You know, there are a lot of news deserts. And so there's a lot of school districts that aren't getting thorough coverage of their budgets. And parents, if they have capacity for this, I think parents in those areas should look page by page through the school district budget. What are they choosing to spend money on, and what are they not choosing to spend money on? And if you think it could be better to voice that.
That public engagement truly does go a long way. Katie Heisen is KPBS's racial justice and social equity reporter. Katie, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And you can read Katie's three-part series on mental health in schools at kpbs.org. And if you are experiencing a mental health or behavioral health crisis, the number to call for help and resources is 988. When we come back, the Padres are back in action, so are the Wave FC, and San Diego State's men's basketball has another successful season. We catch up on San Diego sports next. You're listening to KPBS Roundtable.
Hi, I'm Maya Tribulsi, news anchor for KPBS Evening Edition. At KPBS, we're storytellers, providing trusted, accurate news and information to our community. But not everyone realizes how important that is. And that's why we're asking you to tell that story during Public Media Giving Days. Share what inspires you on KPBS. Text, call, or post with hashtag PublicMediaGives. And thanks.
Welcome back to KPBS Roundtable. I'm Scott Rodd. What a week for San Diego sports. The San Diego Padres are back. They started their first homestand of the season with a 6-4 win over the San Francisco Giants yesterday. It also marked the end of the San Diego State Aztecs men's basketball season. They lost to the UConn Huskies in the Sweet 16 round of the NCAA tournament in a rematch of last year's championship game. Plus, soccer is back. The San Diego Wave FC started their 2024 season with a loss last weekend in front of a big home crowd. They look to turn things around later tonight at Snapdragon Stadium. So, a lot to cover. Here to help us get a handle on everything happening in the San Diego sports world is Ryan Finley. He's the sports editor with the San Diego Union-Tribune. Ryan, thanks for being here in what I imagine is a busy day in the life of a San Diego sports journalist.
It sure is. You know, March is among the busiest times for us, and certainly Thursday was no exception. You had the Padres season opener at 1:10. The Aztecs played at 4. There's other college basketball going on opening day throughout the rest of baseball. Just a super fun time if you're in the sports world. But yesterday, yeah, Thursday was a long day.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's get started with the San Diego State Aztecs men's basketball team. Another great season, they made it to the Sweet 16 in the NCAA tournament, but again, met their match in the UConn Huskies, who they lost to last year in the championship game. Tell us about the game and how this season unfolded.
You know, I think that the game went about how many thought it would. UConn has been described by its own coach as bulletproof, and the Huskies certainly looked that way Thursday night. Not only are they big, but they're very skilled and very deep. And if San Diego State was going to have a problem with any team left in this tournament, it was going to be UConn. UConn's won 9 straight NCAA tournament games by an average of 15 points or more. In this year's NCAA tournament, they're beating their opponents by an average of 28.7 points per game. San Diego State lost by an even 30 on Thursday night, and so that's pretty much in line with what's happened. You know, it was just a tough matchup for the Aztecs all the way around. Throughout the season, they were led by Jaden Ledee, who may have put together the greatest single-season performance by any San Diego State men's basketball player ever. He is a fantastic forward, a great rebounder, a scoring machine, but UConn smothered him. They had bigger, stronger, more skilled players. And that really, you could see the frustration in Ledee as the game went on. He scored something like 11 or 12 of San Diego State's points really early and then went through essentially a scoring slump. It was just a bad matchup. And, you know, that's what you see in the NCAA tournament, right? It's sometimes just matchups matter almost more than the seeds do. And San Diego State is a number 5 seed, certainly belonged in the Sweet 16, but UConn's going to be a handful for not only the Aztecs, but anybody else who they play the rest of the way in this tournament.
Absolutely. You know, the Aztecs typically have a pretty solid defense. Last night, they couldn't buy a rebound, it seemed like. So, yeah, that observation about the matchup often matters more than the number next to the team, you know, in terms of seeding. What's the outlook for SDSU men's basketball next year and for the years to come?
You know, I think that it's optimistic, but it's unclear. San Diego State is going to lose a lot of players this offseason just due to graduation and sort of the churn that exists within college basketball now. We live in a world where name, image, and likeness and the ability to pay players oftentimes dictates how good you are on the basketball court. San Diego State is, I think, a little bit late to that game, though it's certainly trying to catch up in terms of NIL and what it can offer players to come play at San Diego State and to stay at San Diego State. To me, that's going to be a really tough one. I would keep an eye on San Diego State. Had one freshman this year who had redshirted because of an ankle injury. The guy's name is Magoon Gwath. He's a big man who can shoot, somebody who I think might step right in next year as a redshirt freshman and really stand out. Outside of that, there's a lot of decisions that need to be made here in the next week or so. Who is staying, who is going, who wants to maybe pursue another year of eligibility. And again, who can San Diego State get with the relatively limited name, image, and likeness resources that they have? You know, this isn't a pay-for-play situation like you see at some of the major colleges, but you really do, if you're San Diego State, need to have to be able to offer something. And, you know, they can offer Brian Dutcher, and they can offer the ability to develop players. And I'd argue that few programs in America develop as many good players as San Diego State does. But there needs to be some money there too. And I think that that's what we'll see in the coming weeks, is a push to try to get more money into their NIL program so they can go get, you know, essentially free agent basketball players during this offseason.
Well, we'll be watching in the coming weeks to see how things shuffle. Let's move on to soccer. San Diego Wave FC had their regular season opener last weekend. They lost that match, but my understanding is they broke another attendance record. Is that right?
They sure did. Yeah, it was something like 34,000 people packed in the Snapdragon Stadium to watch the Wave. They lost 2-1 at home to the Kansas City Current. The Wave, they're a phenomenon within San Diego. They've really found a way to draw in, I think, young families and kids to their games. You know, they had an offer last week of $10 tickets upstairs, which I think is a smart way to do it. I think San Diego State's football program could learn something from the way the Wave have approached packing the stadium. They have, you know, star power. What I think makes the Wave unique within San Diego sports is they have, I mean, I would argue three of the top 9 or 10 women's soccer players in the United States playing on their team. And, you know, you could argue maybe two of the top 5 or 6. You have Naomi Girma, who is the reigning U.S. soccer women's player of the year. You have Jaden Shaw, who just set a record for most consecutive U.S. women's national team matches with a goal. And then you have Alex Morgan, who's probably the most recognizable women's soccer player in the world. Somebody who has been with the Wave since their inception and is, you know, most Wave fans' favorite player. You've got these three just budding superstars, and there's some real star power there. And you can see the Wave really trying to take advantage of it this year at Snapdragon Stadium.
What do you think their chances are of bringing San Diego a championship this season after coming close the last 2 years?
Yeah, I think it's good. Look, I'm a San Diego native. Grew up here, followed San Diego sports my whole life. I will never jinx something by saying that some team should win a championship because they haven't yet. But the San Diego Wave certainly have the talent. You know, they won the NWSL Shield last year as the top regular season team in their league. They were the number one seed in the tournament. They had a championship match scheduled for Snapdragon Stadium, whether they played in it or not. They had their opportunity last year to really win a championship and lost in the semifinals here at home. That said, I think that they come back with a team that's just as good, if not better. There won't be the long break like there was last year for the Women's World Cup. There will be a shorter break for the Olympics. I think that this is a team that certainly on paper matches up as well as anybody in the NWSL.
And the Padres had their home opener yesterday and got the win. How'd the team look out there in their first game at Petco Park?
You know, they did something that they didn't do a whole lot of last year, right? Come from behind. They trailed, I think, twice to the Giants in Thursday's game and then put it together. Scored some runs late. Big hit from Jake Cronenworth. We didn't see a whole lot of those last year, although he was certainly a big part of their team when they made it to the NLCS in 2022. You saw good pitching from Yu Darvish. You saw some opportunistic base running. Fernando Tatis was doing what he does. You know, he went from first base to third base on a ground out. I think that they played their style of baseball well. And what I'm really looking forward to watching here in the coming days and weeks is how this year's team is different under new manager Mike Shildt. He's talked about essentially doing the little things. He talks about doing things on the edges to try to win games. And you know, you can tell early on he's managing every game like it's game 7 of the World Series, which I think after last year they had such a rough start and preached throughout the year that it, you know, it wasn't too late and that they still had time. Mike Shildt's treating every game like the to mix my sports metaphors here, every game is the Super Bowl now. Every manager tries to win every game, but it seems like there is some tinkering and some strategy under him so far that we didn't see a whole lot of under Bob Melvin a year ago. Now, whether managing becomes micromanaging as we go through the season, you know, we'll have to see. But I certainly like what I've seen from their approach through the first three games of their season. You know, they're 2-1. They have a winning record. They didn't have a winning record very often last season. And this is a team who I think has at least the belief that they can make the playoffs, maybe as a wild card team this year.
Well, the Padres do look quite a bit different compared to last year. You mentioned the new manager, Mike Shildt, who is tinkering, very hands-on. But, you know, superstar Juan Soto is now a Yankee. What stands out to you about this team at the start of the season compared to last year? And what does the team need to do if they're going to make a deep run into the playoffs?
Yeah, there's less star power, that's for sure. You know, you look this team. The team that took the field yesterday had new guys playing second base, shortstop, third base, left field, center field. They have 3/5 of a new starting rotation and a new closer. There are a lot of new faces on this team. You know, the keys to their team remain the same, right? The keys to their team remain Manny Machado, Fernando Tatis Jr., a better season from Xander Bogaerts, and consistent pitching from Yu Darvish, Joe Musgrove, and new acquisition Dylan Cease. If those guys can all perform, the Padres will make the playoffs. That said, you know, I think that their margin for error is a lot less than it was a year ago. They really have to play a certain way every night to win games. I think that this team is still missing a bat somewhere in their lineup, whether that's a left fielder or maybe somebody who can platoon in either left or center. Jurickson Profar is their everyday left fielder right now. It remains to be seen whether that's a smart move for the course of an entire season. That's what they need. They need a bat. Now, fortunately, they do have a little bit of money to spend. I believe they can spend another $13 million this year without going over the competitive balance tax, which is essentially a soft salary cap within Major League Baseball. They have $13 million to play with. It will be a buyer's market. If not now, then at the trade deadline. But I think that their strategy right now is to sort of see what they have, test out some of these young players like center fielder Jackson Merrill and Michael King, who's a new acquisition starting pitcher from the Yankees, really see what they have and then assess the situation and maybe go get a bat. I mean, maybe they go get a bat and maybe they go get a starting pitcher. I don't think that on paper they're that far off from being a playoff caliber team.
Well, only 160-ish games left in the season. We'll be watching to see how things shape up. Ryan Finley is sports editor with the San Diego Union-Tribune. Ryan, thanks so much for taking the time to be with us today.
Anytime.
When we come back, we talk about some other stories we've been following this week on the Weekly Roundup. That's next on Roundtable. Welcome back to Roundtable. It's now time for our weekly roundup of stories we've been following. Joining me is Andrew Bracken. Andrew, how's it going?
Pretty good. How you doing, Scott?
I'm doing pretty good. All right, what stories caught your attention this week?
Well, this first one I'd mentioned, you know, we had this conversation earlier about the mental health struggles in youth today. And there's a pretty big book coming out related to it, at least. It's Jonathan Haidt's new book called The Anxious Generation, and it really kind of puts the blame on a lot of these mental health problems we've been seeing with young people at the foot of smartphones in our digital cultures. And The Atlantic's Hannah Rosen had an interview with the author, but I just thought it was funny. I mean, I wanted to mention the author kind of starts, you know, it's an audio interview as well, and she starts by interviewing her 20-year-old son, and the banter there is pretty hilarious and kind of familiar to me, honestly. Like, I have younger kids, but she's like asking him questions and he's texting his friends in the middle of the conversation, and she's like, "Are you texting your friends right now?" So I thought that was definitely something familiar to a lot of parents, but this is a big ticket issue, and I'm going to read the book because he has a lot to say about the mental health of young people as it relates to technology.
I actually heard a couple of interviews that he's done on this topic, on this book that he has coming out. From what I could tell, his argument is that, you know, this essentially young people being glued to their phones, and not just phones, but social media, it, you know, causing heightened anxiety, this kind of fear of missing out, and that's causing people to be glued to their phones sometimes when they don't even want to be. If you ask them, you know, would you prefer to be doing something else as opposed to being on TikTok, they would say yes, but at the same time they'd say, well, I don't want to miss out on what may be happening with my friends. And so, I don't know, you've got young kids, so what's your experience been? What are your thoughts as they get older and they enter this sort of brave new world of, you know, smartphones being just a piece of almost who they are?
Scott, I mean, we're just navigating it right now. I do feel like inherently, for better and worse, the internet is part of their childhood and their experiences. Their humor is so based in these memes and things. It's really interesting. Again, I don't have the answers. I think every family is struggling with it. But what I'm trying to at least impart to my kids is just a sense of being responsible and thinking about how you might say something in a flash on a text message and how that can really last a lifetime. It can, you know what I mean? You can really have long-lasting impacts. And, you know, with young people, they don't always have, you know, my kids do have stories of interactions online that are a little concerning, I guess I'd say. Scott, what about you? What stories are on your mind this week?
One for sure is the sentencing of Sam Bankman-Fried. He was the founder of the FTX cryptocurrency exchange. This was like a remarkable rise, meteoric rise, and then astounding fall of this, you know, he's now 32. He was in his 20s when this FTX platform was really rising. Just like a remarkable story of this company that really embodied a lot of the ethos and enthusiasm around cryptocurrency, and just in a week span in late 2022, it all came crashing down. There was essentially a kind of run on, you know, people who had invested in FTX, went to go get their money out, and it exposed this $8 billion hole, basically, in this company where, you know, what it comes down to is just fraud. You know, they were taking this money, they were using it for other purposes. Sam Bankman-Fried had made a number of political donations, they were spending it elsewhere. They had moved their headquarters to this sort of Bahamas compound. It's a remarkable story. And in fact, if people are interested in learning more, I'd recommend Michael Lewis's book, Going Infinite. It's a great kind of behind the scenes tale of how this all unfolded and then came crashing down. But Sam Bankman-Fried, he was sentenced to 25 years in prison. And that is, from what I read in the New York Times, at least, one of the higher sentences for a white collar crime in recent years. And it just goes to show, I think, that prosecutors are not taking this lightly, this type of fraudulence, this type of activity. I think they're really going to try to crack down on this. So that definitely caught my attention. I'd been waiting to see what sort of punishment might be handed down for Sam Bankman-Fried. And so 25 years, it's pretty significant.
Yeah, that's a lot. Yeah, I haven't been following the story that closely, but I definitely remember, you know, all the Super Bowl commercials, all the celebrities that kind of went on that bandwagon and how quickly it just kind of went away for him. And, you know, for a lot for that industry. I think since then, we hear so much about crypto, and obviously it's still kind of going through ups and downs. But, you know, the scandal with Bankman-Fried and what happened there, not long after that, I felt like sort of the tech story became like artificial intelligence, and we went to focus on like the new thing.
Yeah, absolutely. you know, it lost its luster. You know, the crypto yeah. sort of craze had, you know, come and gone. And, you know, there's still people who firmly believe in crypto's value as some as a sort of disruptor for traditional currencies and how, you know, financial markets work. And so there are those true believers, people who still see, you know, a value and a future for cryptocurrency. But there really was a lot of hype, grift that surrounded a lot of these, you know, platforms or individual coins. And I think this really is a kind of a nail in the coffin of a certain phase of cryptocurrency where yeah. I think we'll look back and be like, wow, do you remember that phase that, you know, all of this hype, you know, all of this scandal? And a lot of that came to a head with this sentencing. Again, 25 years in prison. He's 32 years old. So, yeah. But yeah, that was definitely something that I'd been waiting to see what happened. So yeah. when that story came down, it definitely caught my attention. All right, on to the next, some local news that you've been paying attention to. What do you got?
Our colleague, Corey Suzuki, he had a story about how energy bills were changing for folks in Imperial County. And I just thought it was interesting. You know, last week's show, we talked a little bit about energy and some of what's going on there with Power San Diego and SDG&E. But this focuses on the Imperial Valley and how the Imperial Irrigation District is sort of changing this way it charges for energy. It's trying an average monthly billing system. And I think the idea is just to level out your monthly bills a little bit more, especially, you know, like in Imperial, it gets really hot in the summers. So I think Corey reports on some people saying basically their bills would double in the summertime. And so what this would do is, you know, customers may see like a slight increase right now, but the thinking is it's going to be more of like a balanced, predictable bill going forward. I thought that was interesting.
That is interesting. I'm sure I imagine it's very hard for, you know, families, especially if they're on, you know, a tight budget to try to anticipate, you know, how much their bill might increase in the summer. Cause you know, you'll know it's going to go up, but you may not know just how much. So that offering that kind of predictability for families, I'm sure will mean a lot.
Yeah, I'm interested to see. I mean, I think we've talked to Eric Anderson, others about how in the last few years we had seen a rise in the number of customers behind on their bills related to energy. I think that number has come down somewhat in the last year or so, but it is an ongoing problem. So maybe that would help with that.
Interesting. Definitely. There's another local story that I saw that I wanted to mention in the roundup. It's from the San Diego Union Tribune. The world's largest artificial reef is off the coast of San Diego. I didn't know that. I don't know if you knew that.
I didn't either, no.
But it was built off the coast near San Onofre, the nuclear power plant. And it's been around for several decades now, and it's just now starting to thrive. And the reason why it had been developed in the first place, where there were some, you know, issues with the impacts of the power plant and its impacts on wildlife. And so this reef is essentially, it's, you know, it's described as an anchor for this like giant kelp. It helps foster, you know, different types of fish that can live there, different, you know, other sorts of creatures, basically. And there was a requirement for this reef to be developed to combat some of those problems that developed as a result of the plant. And now it's finally starting to really take shape. It's starting to do what it was intended to do. Some good news there. I mean, it is nice to hear, considering all of the problematic things that are happening in the ocean. I mean, you're hearing about reefs elsewhere dying off. You're hearing about microplastics in the water, pollution on the southern border from, you know, the sewage crisis. It was refreshing to hear that there was something positive and moving in the right direction that are happening in the waters here off the coast of San Diego.
Yeah, and just that idea that kind of nature will come back, it'll fight its way back is pretty interesting.
Yeah, it needed monitoring and a helping hand. There was a concerted effort around it. But I think with that hand up, yeah, I mean, nature will push back. Nature's a strong force that with some help and some guidance and some investment, you know, definitely will bounce back. So it was great to see that for sure.
Yeah.
What else? What else caught your attention?
Another story that I saw that I found was kind of interesting is California has a lot of video game studios. We've seen a lot of video game industry job losses the past few months, similar to kind of the tech industry. But there's been a lot of people losing their jobs in that industry. San Diego has at least a few major video game publishers in town as well. a major studio, I think they're mostly in Irvine in Southern California, voted to unionize this week. And this was a Sega studio, Sega Sammy Studios. And it's really one of the first examples of a video game studio unionizing, whereas in movies and in other industries, it's very common. But in video games, it hasn't been a part. And I worked in the video game industry for many years. And again, San Diego has kind of a pretty rich history of having video game jobs here. So I'm just interested to see where that goes and what comes of it.
That's fascinating. It's the first, you know, major studio to unionize. It's always interesting to hear, you know, I would have maybe assumed that video game studios were already along that path. It's interesting to hear how different industries are at different points in terms of whether or not they've, you know, had unions, or in this case, you know, it's the first major one. That's really interesting. Having been in the video game industry, I don't know, what's your take on it? How do you think this might change working in the industry?
I wonder if it would just bring a little more stability and predictability, because I think one thing is, if you ever meet someone that works in the video game industry, is it really common to go through layoffs and then move across the country and then get laid off a few years later? It's a very common experience where a company might be working on a game and they really staff up, and then they finish the game, or they kind of at least tone it down, and then layoffs occur. It's a pretty natural cycle in that industry. So I'm just curious to see how, like, job protections, I guess, would potentially be impacted there.
Yeah, something to watch. Absolutely. Well, that's it for this week's roundup. Andrew Bracken, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to KPBS Roundtable. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at roundtable@kpbs.org or leave us a message at 619-452-0228. You can also listen to our show anytime as a podcast. KPBS Roundtable airs on KPBS FM at noon on Fridays and again Sundays at 6 a.m. Roundtable is produced by Andrew Bracken. Brendan Trufa is our technical producer. Brooke Ruth is our senior producer. And I'm Scott Rodd. Thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Maya Tribulsi, news anchor for KPBS Evening Edition. At KPBS, we're storytellers, providing trusted, accurate news and information to our community. But not everyone realizes how important that is. And that's why we're asking you to tell that story during Public Media Giving Days. Share what inspires you on KPBS. Text, call, or post with hashtag Public Media Gives. And thanks.